What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Ryan Burge. So Ryan is a political scientist, and before you start to think that this is just some sleepy political science episode, you are in for a real treat here because Ryan is so high energy. That is one of the reasons I wanted to bring him on the show. Like, he just exudes this energy and this passion for social sciences. And so in this episode, we talk about what social science is. We talk about how he got to being a political scientist, how all that sort of stuff went down. And then we talk about his book called The Nuns, which is about this group of the religiously unaffiliated in America, which now accounts for as much of the population as Catholics and evangelicals do. And he has this book is about this research that he's done into the nuns and just showing us what the world really looks like. I feel like we have these misconceptions a lot of times of what the world actually looks like. And people in the social sciences, that's what they do, is they show people what the world actually looks like. And so in this episode, you get a picture of what the world actually looks like for this group of the religiously unaffiliated. Ryan's also a pastor. And so we talk about how his research into social science plays into his church and vice versa, and how all that interplays. And so you're just in for a real treat on this episode. You're going to learn a lot. Yeah, I can't wait for you to hear from him. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the amazing people I have coming on this show. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Ryan. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and talking with me, man. It's super nice to meet you.
Absolutely. It's going to be a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, well, let's just jump off and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Yeah, my name is Ryan Burge. I hold a PhD in political science from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois. I am the assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, Illinois. I'm also the graduate coordinator there, so I run our graduate program, which has online and in-person components. On top of that, I am a pastor in the American Baptist Church. I've served my current church, First Baptist Church of Mount Vernon, Illinois, for over 14 years now. And in total, I have about 18 years of service to the American Baptist Churches in the Great Rivers region of ABC USA, which is Missouri and Illinois. I'm a husband. My wife and I have been married for 13 years now, been together for almost 20 years, and we have two boys, one who has just turned 9 and one who is 6 and a half.
Nice. I love it. I love that you're a bivocational pastor, because I am as well. And I think that's like I think this is something we need to be talking about is that. So I kind of see, I want to talk about your vocation and how you came to like your careers, you know, sort of like in tandem. So maybe like, how did all that go down? Like, I know you were in college and sort of like started them. Like, how did all that sort of play out?
Yeah. So I grew up evangelical in a Southern Baptist church. And I was the type of kid who was there at church probably 4 days a week, all through high school. My youth pastor and I had a very good relationship. In some ways, he became like a surrogate father for me. I didn't grow up in a bad environment. My parents are still married, but they just weren't the most supportive people in the world. They were sort of like distant and absent from my life in a lot of ways. So I wanted out of the house. And my youth pastor was a guy who was like, yeah, just come hang out. So, you know, we just hung out at the church all the time. So I sort of took the lead in youth group, you know, when I turned 15, 16, 17 years old. So that sort of hit a lag, though. I went to a Free Methodist undergraduate school that was actually pretty rigorous from a spiritual standpoint. We had to go to chapel 3 times a week. So I was going to chapel, and I actually was a ministry minor. I remember when I was a senior in high school, I told one of my teachers, they said, what are you going to do when you grow up? I go, I want to be a youth pastor and a lawyer. And they laughed at me, you know, which looking back on it now is a laughable thing to say. But I always kind of joke like I didn't miss it by a whole lot,
true.
You know, like I'm still like sort of like half right on both of them. So what really happened was after my freshman year in college, I needed a job and I worked at Walmart. And after my sophomore year in college, I needed a job and I called Walmart and they said, we don't have a job for you. And I was like, oh, no, I'm like full on panic mode because I need to work, you know, to make money. So what happened was I was in a philosophy of youth ministry class. with a professor and began the class by saying, hey, I was at a ministerial alliance meeting and one of the pastors there said they're looking for a summer intern for the youth group. And the town that he was talking about was a town that was like 20 minutes from where I grew up and like where are really like our rivals in sports. So like this is a town I was very familiar with. And so and it was First Baptist Church of Centralia, Illinois. And I was like, well, I'll give it a shot. So I applied and I got hired at 20 years old to be a youth pastor intern. I did that. It was supposed to be a 3-month contract just for the summer, and it ended up being 3 years. So I was there. Actually, I was there until I was going to go away to graduate school, and then I quit to go into the PhD program. And then when I was in the PhD program, I needed a way to make money. To be honest with you, I needed a way to make money. I mean, I'm not going to like make it all spiritual sure, right now. Right. And I talked to our ABC folks and I said, hey, is there any churches in this area around Carbondale that need a pastor? And they said, yeah, actually, we have one. It's a bunch of 80-year-old people. You want to pastor it? And it's like 30 people. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? So I did that for a year. And then I quit because I got a graduate assistantship at Carbondale. And I thought I couldn't do both. Like I was just didn't want to stretch myself too thin. Plus, the church wasn't a really great fit for a whole bunch of reasons, namely because I was 23 and they were all 85. But what happened was as soon as I quit that, in September of that first year on the graduate assistantship, a church in Mount Vernon, Illinois called me and said, you want to come preach? And I said, yeah, sure. And they called me the next Sunday and said, you want to come preach? And I said, yeah, sure. And they called me the next Sunday and said, you want to become our interim pastor? And I said, I mean, I guess I do. And that was 14 years ago, October of 2006. So I have been their pastor now. I started there when I had a bachelor's degree. I got a master's degree. I got married. I got a PhD. I bought a house. I had two kids. I got a job, another job on top of that, all while being their pastor. So that church was about 50 people when I started in 2006. And now it's down to about 20 folks who are all eligible for the vaccine right now in the state of Illinois. So we've just been hanging on. We're kind of we're a church that's just declining in size. We're dying off, just to be completely blunt. But that's always just been part of who I am. And I sort of love having these different hats that I wear. I think it makes me a better, being a social scientist makes me a better pastor, and being a pastor makes me a better social scientist and teacher. Yeah. I think I'm better in the classroom and better just mentoring students and, you know, helping them and advising students because of that ministry background. I really do have a heart for students. So, you know, I think those two things actually work really well together. And I couldn't imagine being a pastor full time. I just don't think that's not what God has for me. But I also don't think I could just be an academic. I have to be doing a lot of things at once. Otherwise, I get bored. And when I get bored, that's when the darkness comes in. So I don't want to be bored.
I totally resonate with that in so many ways. But I do agree that having a vocation besides being a pastor like has a lot of advantages. You know, we could talk about the disadvantages too, but I think people don't see that enough as like a possible, you know, solution for like, you know, you have a church with like a solo pastor sort of running every single thing in the church. Why not bring on a couple pastors that are bivocational and sort of spread out some of this work? And so I think there's a lot to it. So why then political science and like what led you down that trail?
I wish I could say I had like some sort of like deep abiding love of political science, but I really didn't. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I'm a first gen college student. My parent, like I talked about my parents, they didn't really know much about college to help me, like advise me like on what to do in college. So my undergraduate major was history/political science because the department was so small, they couldn't do both. And then a minor in religion philosophy. And I remember I graduated and I went to the world of work for a while, worked a couple of part-time jobs. And I thought, I hate this. Like I miss the academic world.
Sure.
Like I miss the conversation, the discussion, the free exercise of speech, you know, where we can talk about anything and it's okay. And talk about the higher things in life. I missed all that stuff. And so I actually applied. I took the GRE, applied to a couple of big schools, not realizing how hard it is to get into a really good school. I mean, I was always a smart guy and always did well in school and things like that, but I wasn't prepared for how much the bar jumps from undergraduate to graduate school. So I applied to two really, really good schools and didn't get into either of them. And then I was like, well, what am I going to do? I guess I'll apply to schools here at the last minute and just get a master's degree in political science. So I actually applied to SIU in June for an August enrollment, which looking back on now is completely ridiculous. Like never. And then I didn't even get an assistantship that first year. I didn't even know what an assistantship was, right, to be honest with you, that first year. Like I was completely in the dark and then realized, holy cow, like they'll pay you to come to graduate school and pay your tuition and give you a stipend. And so after my first year, I got an assistantship the second year, and then that paid for my education, my graduate education. So I paid like $5,000 to get a PhD from start to finish. But I didn't realize that until, you know, farther in. So like now I honestly have a passion for talking to my students, my undergraduates, my first gen undergraduates, to tell them like, listen, if you're smart and dedicated, you can do this. Like you can get a PhD. So what drove me to political science, honestly, was I was going to go to law school and I've always just liked politics. So it just seemed like a good fit to go into policy. Like I really wanted to go into the policy space for a while, like work for government, be a bureaucrat, because I understood those are stable jobs with good, you know, good incomes and good benefits. And I thought, well, I could go for that good, stable life. But it's just so funny how you sort of stumble through life and figure it out as you go along. And I really don't believe it didn't really make sense to me until I started writing my thesis, which was at the end of my second year, like that I actually liked doing that work. And I really didn't like come into my own as a political scientist until honestly 10 years after I started the PhD program. Huh. I really didn't feel like I belonged. I really didn't know like what my niche was, you know, what my groove was. And it really took until about 2015 or 2016 for me to really say, okay, this is who I am and this is what I'm about. So that's what I tell my students. They're like, what am I going to do when I grow up? And they're like 21. I'm like, listen, I was like 32 or 33 before I even figured out like what in the world I was doing. So you're going to be fine. Just keep stumbling forward and keep making progress. And eventually you'll figure it out, because that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah, I think that's a good word for all of us right there, because it you have this clear cut path when you're at that age, like going into undergrad or whatever, of like, these are the steps I need to take. This is how this is all going to play out. And then you get there and you're like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And will I ever, I guess. And so, yeah, I resonate.
Oh, I mean, for sure. Like if you would have told me 10 years ago that I would have written, you know, 24 journal articles, a book, 3 book chapters, been in the Washington Post, New York Times, you know, The Economist, like, I'd be like, you're crazy. Like, what are you talking about? But it's, you know, your life moves. It's like a ship. You know what I mean? Like you turn the rudder and you just start moving a little bit in one direction. Then you keep sort of course correcting as things, you know, happen in your life. My big thing, and I tell my students this, is that you should have no 0 days. And what I mean by a 0 day is where you wake up and you go to bed and you did nothing to move forward when it comes to your goals and your aspirations in life. So my whole mentality has always been, I need to be productive every single day of my life. And that productivity is incremental, but in the aggregate, it ends up being monumental when you look at it over the span of 2 or 3 or 5 years.
Right.
Right. And you got to start planting seeds now for where you're going to be in 5 years from now. So my whole thing was, I'm going to just work. And, you know, if you're a pretty smart person and you work hard, you're honestly going to get far in life. I mean, that's just the way that it's worked for me. And I haven't had a ton of advantages. I understand I'm a white male in academia. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I, you know, I didn't come from a family with money. I didn't come from an academic family. You know, so like everything I've gotten, I basically earned on my own, but I've gotten it through hard work. But also the fact, realizing that for whatever reason, God gave me a pretty decent mind that works pretty well. And to not use that to its full potential is not what God has called me to do. Like to me, that's my biggest fear, is not using what God gave me to bless as many people as I possibly can. That's what gives me a sense of, okay, I can lay my head on my pillow tonight and go, I did good today. Like I've made the world a better place today. Because if God gives you a gift and you don't use it, I think potential is the most deadly word in the English language. Like this student has a lot of potential. Potential does not matter for anything. Mm. All right. Actualize that. Actually do something with that. Because I went to school, grad school and undergrad, with people with so much potential, and 90% of them just flamed out, gave up, did not push, became complacent. And that's just not my mentality when it comes to ministry, when it comes to, you know, academia. I'm just internally motivated, and that is what gets people. That's what gets you where you want to go, right? You can't just fall forward. You got to push yourself forward and drag yourself forward sometimes. And that's really, you know, my whole life's evidence of that.
Yeah. I think that's important. I think that's a good word for us to, I totally agree. How do you though? I mean, you're a professor, you know, you're running a grad program. How do you, though, make sure that you're not burning out while doing so many things at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, I'm a guy who is, I'm not exhausted by work. I'm energized by work. Sure. Because I feel like that's fulfilling my purpose. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like a lot of these people are like, oh, self-care, you know, you don't have to work all the time. Like, let's not glorify like burnout culture or whatever. I struggle with that because I'm a guy who wants to work every day. Mm. Like I feel awful when I take a day off. Like it hurts my mental health to take a day off. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't work 100 hours a week, but when I work, I work. Sure. Like I think the thing that always works in my benefit is I'm very efficient in my work. So I can get a lot done in like 4 hours. Right. So I can then blow off the rest of the day and go watch Netflix or go sledding with my kids like I did yesterday. Right. So I can get a lot when I'm working, I'm working and I'm not distracting myself with Twitter or Facebook. I'm writing, right? Like I've written a whole paper in 3 days before. So like I wrote the book in basically like a 6 week stretch, a 160-page book. So like when I'm working, I'm working. So for me, work is what gives me purpose and gives me meaning. Like if I don't make a graph in a day, it's a bad day. I think I think last year I made 1,050 graphs in 365 days. And I made a graph like 90% of the days I made a graph because that's just what gives me joy. So like for me, I'm a guy who just wants to keep moving. I'm not a good person at like sitting on the couch and like every single day and just watching TV like nonstop. Honestly, my biggest fear right now is retirement. I'm not even close to that. But like that terrifies me when I get to 62, 64 and it's like, okay, time to quit now because everyone's telling me to quit. Like, what am I going to do all day?
Right.
Like boredom is like my biggest enemy. Hmm. So like I'm really worried about like what, you know, how to not be bored. And maybe my mind will change going forward because I'm sort of like in the peak. An academic peak is like mid-30s to mid-40s. Like right. That's really when you get your best work done. And I'm sort of in that peak right now. So I want to try to maximize that peak. But right now, I just cannot imagine not going full speed ahead for as long as humanly possible. Because it's just what I have to do to be a good husband, a good pastor, a good academic, a good father. I have to work. So I think it all works together for me. And work is not draining. It's actually energizing.
Yeah. It was funny to read in your book how you like some new information had come out and like you could not wait to get home and like we're thinking about like making a graph while you know putting your kids down and stuff that like you know just that need to create those graphs is just so pressing. Oh, right?
Yeah, my hands will shake sometimes when I'm coding, like seeing it, because like I'll see something, like especially like around election time, like I'll see something in the data really quick and I'm like, oh, this has got to get out, but I need to visualize this in a nice way because I know that Twitter is a visual medium, so I need to do good on that. But it's like, it's also a race though, because you're racing other academics to try to get to the punch, because if the data is publicly available, they're going to try to race to it too. I mean, that is what gets me so excited though, because it's like, you know, the thing about social media is it is a democratizing medium. You know, people are like, it's a hellscape. Like I doom scroll. And it is like Twitter can be a very negative place, yeah. But I'm an academic who went to a very not good PhD program, who's teaching at a very middling institution right now. Like I'm not at like Harvard or MIT. I'm at Eastern Illinois University, but I am one of the go-to persons for religion and politics in America. And the reason I am that is because of what I did on social media. Mm. Not because of my credentials, because on social media, no one cares if you went to Harvard or, you know, Podunk University. If you put out good stuff consistently, they're going to follow you. They're going to retweet you. They're going to see you as an influencer. They're going to, you know, so that's what I love about social is it just breaks down right. All the walls of pedigree and, you know, all the ivory tower stuff. It's if you're good, you're good, period. And so, you know, that's what people don't realize, like, the internet's awful, but it's also amazing all at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, the things that make it terrible are the things that make it great. And that, you know, these people on YouTube who become famous for making videos, like that is amazing if you think back about it. Because 10 years ago, they would have no path to success in life.
Yeah.
And now they have a huge path to success in life. And why I had a book contract is because I wrote for social. Right. Why I've, you know, published 24 articles, why I've been, you know, in the Washington Post, why I get these speaking engagements, all because of what happened on social. Like to me, like people are like, get off Twitter. Like all these academics are like, get off Twitter. It's a waste of time. I'm like, it's the opposite of a waste of time for me. It is the, like the center hub and all the spokes come off of Twitter. Like, that's how my life works. And to think people are like, it's a waste of your time. It's like, it's a waste of your time if you're not using it correctly. And I think that's what a lot of academics don't understand.
Well, and I think it's interesting because academia, I'm in the theology world, right? That's where my higher education comes from. But in that, at least in this world, like, academia is so far removed from anybody who could actually benefit a lot of times from academics. You know, it's like academics want to stay, it seems, in their sort of academic world, and it's like a lot more comfortable there. But Twitter like immediately puts like this academic world into a world where like average people can sort of hear what you have to say and see the social sciences that you're doing.
Yeah, no, that's the key. I mean, I am a bad academic. Like, I'll be the first to say, like, I went to a thing last year with a bunch of other academics, and it was like a 2-day workshop, and I hated every single minute of it. I felt so out of place. Like, I was on my laptop, like, Googling the words they were using because I'd never heard them before. And I have a PhD in political science. Right. Like, I'm an accomplished, in air quotes, scholar by any metric. And I had no idea what they're talking about. I was like, do you guys hear yourself right now? Like, the people out there don't care about 95% of the things we're talking about in this room right now. They do not care. And their response to me would be like, well, I'm not writing for them. And I get that. Like, listen, that's their perspective. They want to write for their subfield, which is totally fine. I don't want to write for my subfield. Every time I write a paper, I'm always thinking about how that could turn into a tweet or a blog post or an op-ed, right? I'm always thinking about how to convert that into public scholarship, because I would rather write something academically that's maybe a little less rigorous and a little less theoretical, but go on to social and get a lot more traction. Like, that's my sweet spot. So, like, I've written posts for our website that have been read 18,000 times. I bet you everything I've ever written academically, like peer-reviewed journals, if you add them up, might be a tenth of that one post.
Right.
So, like, it makes no sense to me. If academics are writing for other academics, what you're doing is you're creating a larger divide between the average American and you.
Right.
And I've never seen myself that way. Like, I've always been like, I don't know what you call it, academic of the people. Like, I never want to speak down to people. Like, I'm always very cognizant of like how I come across. Like, when I talk to other people, I don't want them to think I'm smarter than them or I'm better than them. I just took a different career path than they did. Like, I'm still a guy who cuts my own grass and I renovated my own house and I like to fix stuff. And like, I'm just a guy. I feel like I'm a blue collar guy who just happened to luck into the ivory tower. You know, like, I don't come. The thing about academia, and this is what people don't realize about academia. Everyone in academia, 90% of people in academia are liberals. And they want to act like, you know, it's all about a meritocracy, right? If you work hard, then you're going to get ahead. But academia is the absolute opposite of that. It is a caste system like you wouldn't believe. For instance, the American Political Science Association had a conference a couple years ago, and they surveyed respondents to that conference and asked them the question, do you have a parent who's in academia? And 40% of them had a parent who was a professor.
Right.
40%! Like, this is a heritable job now. It's not like you were smart, you worked hard at school, you went and got a PhD, and you got in, you cracked into it. It's, no, both my parents are professors, so I'm a professor too. I mean, it's all about pedigree. It's all about who you know. So, like, I'm always a guy who stands on sort of the edge of that between academia and the real world and says, listen, there are a lot of things I love about academia. It's a really good job. I like my friends. I like my colleagues. But there are things about it that just drive me insane. And so that's why I have to have one foot in this world and one foot in that world, because I don't feel like I fit very well into either world, which actually I think is to my benefit, not to my detriment.
Yeah. No, I think that's good. I like that. I think that's important stuff. So I want to get to the book, The Nuns, right? I want to get to your book talking about the nuns. Can you just, before we get to the book, though, explain what the heck you actually do and like what social science even is for the sort of unacquainted, such as myself?
That's a good one. That's a good one. So I'm a quantitative scholar. So I'm a guy who just digs in survey data all day. There's two forks in social science, and one is qualitative work, which is things like ethnography, interviews, focus groups, case studies, that kind of thing. And there's quants, and quants are people who just do math all day. And so I'm a math guy.
Okay.
I just do math nonstop. So my world is survey data. And so what basically I try to do is try to look at surveys that are publicly available or some that I've, funded myself through grants and things like that. and try to help explain the social world, try to make sense of how we got here. Have we always been like this? How are we changing? What does the future look like? And I think that's really like, I think that's like my calling, is to show people like, okay, this is what the world actually looks like. Not what you think it looks like or wish it looked like or hope it looks like, but here's what the world looks like today, which none of us have a good perception of, by the way. But then even 30 years ago, we even have a worse perception of what 30 years ago looks like. Because, you know, surveys aren't perfect, but they're a lot better than the alternative. Sure. You know, people are like, oh, public opinion polling's bad. Like after the 2020 election, like burn it all down. I'm like, what's the alternative? Are you telling me the world will be better without polls? You think we'd rather just fly blind all the time? Just go into the election and be like, well, Trump could win by 20 or he could lose by 20. We have no idea. Like that's such a ridiculous proposition to me. Now they're not as good as they could be. We're working on it. But so my job is to take that quant data and translate it into understanding about the world. Right. And so for me, that is all over the place. I just kind of follow these little threads that are interesting to me about, like, for instance, right now I'm writing a paper about are people more likely to indicate they're Protestant or Christian? If you ask them that on a survey, like, what does the word Protestant mean? And what I found is that people under the age of 55 are more likely to pick Christian than they are Protestant, which tells you something very, I think, important about Christianity in America, which is that the word Protestant now is just not used anymore. And the word Christian has become like the default term. Right. So, you know, little stuff like that. So I track, like I'm trying to understand like how we measure religion on surveys and do that well. You know, for instance, how do we do a good job of understanding people who are maybe shy about really indicating they're not religiously affiliated? Like how do we get around those problems? So I've written papers about like the environment, views of the environment amongst Christian people. My work's all in religion and politics, though. So it's all about how religious variables interact with political variables and just trying to explain the world. So that's what social science really tries to do. My work is, I would say, less theory based. Like I'm not a huge theory guy. Sure. I just honestly don't like theory very much. Mine's like, here's like 8 cool graphs and some words. Let's go. Like that's my style. And so the nuns actually came out of a tweet, which is what the book starts with, is this tweet that I put together in March of 2019, the General Social Survey, which is like this huge, big, like gold standard survey that's publicly available that tracks things back to 1972. And they ask questions about religious affiliation. So I knew it came out. I was actually at work that day. I was driving home already in my head thinking about what I was going to do. And I realized, let's count the nuns, the people who have no religious affiliation. Let's track them over time. And so I found out that the data indicates that the nuns now are the same size as evangelicals and Catholics, which means they are tied for being the three largest religious groups in America for the first time. And so I tweeted that out it basically just took off. As the kids say, it went viral. My most popular tweet ever. It got like 1,200 retweets, including some of the, you know, the biggest accounts on Twitter. Sam Harris retweeted it at one point. It's like probably the most prominent atheist alive today. It just had legs and went on and on and on. And that got me, interviews with the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, the Times of London. In my life just sort of took off from that point. I became a public academic overnight, essentially. Before that, I had like 500, 600 Twitter followers. And, you know, now I have like over 6,000. So that was like really the inflection point in my career. And that's when I started writing for public outlets more and more. More outlets would come to me and say, would you like to write a piece for us about this or that? Christianity Today, Religion News Service. Now I write for Religion Unplugged. They came to me and said, would you like to write about this stuff? And I said, yeah, sure. And so the more I did that, the more doors started opening up for other things. And then a book publisher, sent me an email saying, we want you to pitch a book to us about anything, you know, anything you're interested in. And I said, okay. And so I basically said, I want to write a book about the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated in America. I wrote like a one and a half page treatment where I basically, outlined the chapters, what they were going to be. I already had the idea in my head. I basically wrote the treatment in about an hour. And I sent that off just not really thinking too much about it. And then 2 weeks later, I got a green light saying it's going to go.
It's cool.
We want it. And so I signed the contract in October of 2019. I started writing immediately after that. I wrote the first three chapters in like 2 weeks after that. Then I kind of hit a lull there for a while. And I finished up in May of 2020, and I just got through proofs, copy edits, all that good stuff in November. And it should be out on March the 9th of 2021. It's 160 pages, 31,000 words, 42 graphs, five chapters, all about the religiously unaffiliated in America. And it's really just sort of all my other thoughts, other tweets, other, you know, graphs and stuff sort of collected in an organized fashion,
right,
to try to make a bigger point about. So first off, I track the change in American religion over the last 40 years. But then I think one of the most important chapters for me, at least, is I try to explain how this happened. And I kind of walk through like eight different reasons that people give about why the nuns have increased so rapidly, trying to show that, like, listen, it's a lot more complicated than you think it is, in terms of it's not one thing, it's many things together. And it's probably not what you think it is. And then I sort of break the nuns down into different groups, the atheists, your agnostics, your nothing in particulars. And then I sort of offer some advice about if church folks want to try to bring the nuns back in, how to do that. You know, what are the types of groups you should focus on and how. So it's really a book written, I would say it's slightly tilted towards a Christian audience, but not overly so. I wrote it in that way because I wanted even atheists and agnostics to read the book and learn something about themselves and not feel like they were trying to be proselytized along the way. So the kind of the core audience for me is pastors, denominational leaders, like seminarians. I think it would work really well in a seminary class. Like a world religions class would work well too, if you want to like have a week or two on, you know, secularism is in America. So that's really the pitch of the book. It's really, it's not very, there's no hot takes in there. I'll just say that. It's not, you know, I didn't try to be controversial. I tried to write it in a more neutral tone and more like a textbook style, conversational textbook style that helps you to sort of walk through all the social science research that we have on the nuns.
Well, and I appreciated even just the background of like social sciences. And I appreciated how you sort of broke down like, you know, we put people into these categories here, but there's also these other ways to think about it. And, you know, talking about age gaps and, or, you know, putting people in sort of age clusters and all of that stuff. It made it understandable for someone who's not acquainted with the social science. You know, because you talk about the first of the book, how much pastors love to use sort of like statistics when they preach. And so often, like, they're wrong and they're interpreting them incorrectly and some of that. Can you speak to a little bit of that? Just like social sciences in the church?
Yeah. I think that social science becomes a weapon for a lot of pastors to trot out when they want to make a point. But honestly, they don't know what they're talking about 90% of the time. Sure. You know, they just like, you know, there's that old stupid joke, like 90% of statistics are made up. And I feel like in the pulpit, it's like 100% or very close to 100%. Sure. Listen, you know, like I always joke, like people like, well, after I tell, like, you know, have a sermon where I tell a story, someone will ask me, is that story true? I go, well, it's a preacher story. So what do you think? You know, like, we all know that like most of those are sort of exaggerations or like a little blurry on the edges of truth. Right. But it's not true. It's not true. It's truth. Right. Which are different things. Mm. But when it comes to statistics, I think we need to not just be true. I think we need to be truth. Mm. Right. We need to be as accurate as we can be. And listen, I have a problem when pastors weaponize statistics almost as a form of propaganda. I think that is incredibly scary for a bunch of reasons, because what you're doing is you're teaching your congregation to construct a view of the world that is not accurate to the actual world. Mm. And more often than not, it's to make you look good and them look bad, right, or to separate you two and talk about how different, you know, your Christians are from the world, in quotes, right? Sure. I think those are incredibly dangerous things to do, because then when Christians actually interact in the world, they think it's different than what it actually is. And that, you know, that disjunction creates a lot of friction, I think, that is unnecessary. So I'm a believer in trying to, you know, I'm a guy who says the facts are the facts, whether you like them or not. Mm. That's like a very Trump line, you know, like, screw your feelings or whatever. But like, I honestly say, like, I roll that out to people. I go, I don't care what the data, I don't care how you feel about the data. The data doesn't care about how you feel about it either. It is what it is. Right. Makes you look good, good. If it makes you look bad, good. I don't care. You know, like, my job is to be a truth teller and a referee, an impartial referee. And so, like, I've had weeks where I've gone on a Christian Broadcasting Network on a Tuesday and then done Freedom From Religion Radio on a Thursday. right? So like, I don't care who I'm talking to, right? Because when I'm in academic mode, my job is to have fidelity to the truth, not you or you or you or you, right? To just tell you what the data says. So I want pastors to actually have accurate data from me, because I know it's accurate, because I would not put out inaccurate data, as opposed to like what you found on randombobsblog.com, when Bob is a guy who probably has no background in social science at all and just copied another graph poorly and has no idea what he's talking right. about, right? Like, I am, to put in air quotes, an expert in this field. I am going to tell you what the data says. So listen to what I'm telling you, and then report the world back to your congregation in a way that they can understand it, right? I think that's so important mm-hmm. because pastors miss the mark. Listen, when my plumber comes over, I don't get under the sink with him, okay? I let him do his job. Although I would never call a plumber, I'd fix it myself. You get my point, right? Like,
bad example.
You know, if my car breaks down, yeah. But like, if my car breaks down, I can't fix that because it's all like computerized right, now, right? right? Like, yeah. I'm not going to walk back in the shop and be like, hey guys, what's going on back here? You know what I mean? No. Like, we have to understand, like, stay in your lane. I don't go on Twitter and talk theology. I don't, because I have like, I took like 4 classes in college in theology. Well, I talk about social science because I know my lane, and I stay in my lane. Now, here, the other part of that though is, if you get in my lane, I'm gonna check you. You know, right. like if you try to become a social scientist overnight, I'm gonna tell you you're wrong, because I've spent 15 years of my life getting good at this. So you don't get 15 minutes to come into my lane and tell me that I'm wrong. So I think that's the confidence that I need to have as an academic, but also that pastors need to have in the pulpit. If you want to talk about matters of theology and you have a strong background in theology, like you have an MDiv, you know, you got a PhD in theology, oh my goodness, go ahead. God love you. You know, preach the gospel, talk about parousia and talk about eschatology and talk about, you know, transubstantiation. Go. Like, have a fun time. But if you want to talk about social science statistics, you better rely on people that you can trust who have done it their entire lives. And that's me. So I want to bridge that gap between like, well, I don't know how to talk about it, you know, authoritatively. Well, here's a book, you know, like here's 160 pages that can help you understand right. what is going on. So that's really what the purpose of the book was from a pastor's perspective. Yeah.
I can't tell you how many pastoral meetings I've been in, you know, because we pastors love to just like have meetings and stuff. But, you know, discussing this like nun's revelation that was going on, you know, and so how many people are leaving the church. And then, you know, the point of the meeting is sort of like, to pinpoint what some of those issues are and how we can fix them. And like, just thinking back to them, how like even far off I was from any sort of, you know, truth of what's going on, just because I was so uninformed on that specific thing. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the book, is to take you from the ground floor, right. And take you all the way up and say, listen, they don't look what you look like. They don't think like you think like. And they're not all the same. Right. And I think that one thing I hope like comes through in the book is that all nuns, actually, I think I called the chapter that, all nuns are not created equal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like they're 30% of America now. And to look at them as a monolith would be like saying, yeah, all Protestants are the same.
Yeah.
And every pastor's like, no, like there's even huge differences between different types of Baptists, for goodness sakes. You know, so like to lump all the nuns, 30% of America, into one umbrella is like the most ridiculous thing ever. And so that's why I walk you through, there's atheists, there's agnostics, and there's nothing in particulars. There are three completely different groups. And to try to approach an atheist like you would approach a nothing in particular is completely wrongheaded. And I, the other thing, and this is an important point, I think when people think about the nuns, they think they're all atheists. And the reality is that actually a very small number of them are atheists. So if 30% of all Americans are nuns, only 6% of all Americans are atheists.
Right.
Okay. So it's a small fraction of nuns are atheists. The biggest portion, 2/3 of the nuns, are nothing in particular, which are a group that's completely different than atheists. Most of them are just sort of, they shrug when they're asked about religion.
Right.
They don't like yell at you and like say God is a myth and sky daddy and all that stuff. They're just like, I don't like church. Like that's their mentality. Mm-hmm. And they also have low levels of education. They have low levels of income. Many of them are not married. Like they're a totally different group than atheists are. And you need to understand the differences sociologically and demographically, because those people actually are not allergic to going back to church, as I show. And I think one of the biggest revelations of the book is I show that if you track atheists over time, 95% of them are still atheists 4 years later.
Right.
Like they don't move. And agnostics are basically the same way too. Very few of them actually go, you know, they don't leave that space. but nothing in particulars. Okay. 60% of them are still nothing in particular after 4 years, but 20% become atheists or agnostics, but then 20% become, you know, go back to a faith, right. You know, either with Christianity, Catholicism, Buddhism, Islam, whatever it is, they go back to a faith group. So there's still some movement there. And to me, they're the way station, you know, between the nuns on one side, atheists and agnostics on one side, and in theism on the other side. They're sort of the transfer station where people go back and forth. Very few people go from being like a committed Christian to an atheist, or an atheist to a committed Christian. Right. They sort of have to walk through the transfer station to get to the other side. And to me, if you are a church who wants to grow, that's where the battle is. Like, those are the people you should target. Don't go online and yell. Like, don't go to like the atheist subreddit and start yelling at people. You're wasting your time. Go find the guy who works at the grocery store, who never graduated college, who really feels like he's disconnected, left out, and left behind by society, and say, hey, come to church. Because they might actually say yes, right. And they might. And here's what's crazy about it: they actually might benefit from it more than the people in your church right now. Amen. So,
yeah, I spent 10 years of my early pastoral ministry was spent also working at Starbucks, and mm-hmm. I tell you what, every barista is probably in that nuns category. You know, like anybody you interact with at a Starbucks, something like that, is probably in that nun category, and like. Mm-hmm. These nuns in my experience just want you to not be a jerk. Like that's all it is. It's not some mm-hmm. theological argument. It's just like loving people and caring about them in some way, right?
Yeah. They don't have like some sort of like grand worldview. Right. Their worldview is I'm tired and I don't like people, so I don't want to go to church. Right. Like that's their worldview. And but you have to, I think what you have to do is you have to show them that first off, well, and I talk about this in the book. First off, all Christians are not like hardcore MAGA Trump Republicans, which is becoming harder and harder to convince them of every single day. Right. But you also need to convince them that the church has other benefits beyond the, you know, going to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
Right? It's not about your eternal destination. It actually has huge benefits for the here and now. And those things like, you know, just like well-being.
Yeah.
Things like having a social safety net. If you get sick and you need someone to like take your dog out for a walk or mow your grass, like that's what the church does, or bring food to you. You know, right. If you just had a baby or something like that, I think people miss out on that kind of discussion. And I wrote a post for Christianity Today, like in November of 2019, about how the poor are leaving the church more than the upper middle class and the upper class. Mm. And I think that's to their great detriment. Because church is a great social safety net. You know, like I was at a church one time, we had prayers of the people. It was a more liturgical church. And I remember one guy in the back said, he, during the prayers of the people, he said, could you all pray for me? I lost my job and I'm not sure how we're going to pay the mortgage next month. And, you know, the pastor said, Lord, in our mercy, we all said, hear our prayer. Well, after church was over, one of the guys in the church came up to him and said, hey, you want a job? I've got an open spot at my factory. You know, like yep. God works in mysterious ways yeah. or really, really tangible ways by you like speaking it into the universe, and then God takes care of it, right? And how does God take care of it? By someone going, I know the right thing to do is to give that guy a job and give that guy a chance. And he got the job and got the chance, right? So I think people miss out on the idea that church is not just all about like the higher things in life, the vertical orientation is what we call it in social science. It's all about the horizontal orientation. And I think actually churches need to stop, this sounds terrible, churches need to stop talking about the vertical so much and start talking about the horizontal benefits that you can gain in the here and now. Like the data says that we're more disconnected than we've ever been before. And church is one of the very few things that still exists in society to hold us together as a cohesive whole. And we need people. And church is a great way to find people, especially if you're in your mid-20s or early 30s. You don't really have that, you know, you've kind of broken away from your family and your college and all that stuff. Like, church is ideal for you. So I think that churches need to be more cognizant of those. They don't need to downplay those benefits. I think they oftentimes do. They're like, this is about, it's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus. Okay, it's also about making sure people have, a friend. A support network, a place of a feeling of belonging and attachment to a community of faith and a larger community as well. I think all that stuff is nearly as important to me as the gospel stuff, as the salvific nature of Jesus Christ. I just think that we need to be thinking more about that horizontal dimension, and at churches past. Listen, if you're a theologian, you're not trained to think about that dimension hardly at all. Right. It's all about like up and down. Yeah. And as a social scientist, I'm not trained to think about the up and down at all. I'm only trained to think about the horizontal dimension between us and other people. There's a middle ground there that I think is a good place for a church to think about going for, not just one or the other.
Right. Yeah. I think that's good, Ryan. I like that. I mean, the two greatest commandments, right? Love God and love others, right? I mean, they're both there. And and one compels you to do the other, and vice versa, you know? And so, yeah, I think that is an important part of it. And you see a lot of people just like floating out in the world with nobody that really loves them or cares about them. And I think that, you know, a church to so many people has become a place of extreme judgment rather than a place where you can kind of call home, I guess, you know?
Yeah, and you know where that comes from? It comes from the pulpit, though, too. Right. I think pastors need to do a better job of not projecting they have it all figured out. Like I just don't like the church model of like the pastor's way out in front and we're all sort of like following behind the pastor.
Right.
Like I always think that our leadership style is we're all in a circle and I'm in the circle with everybody else. You know, like we govern by consensus. We lead by consensus. Like I'm not a general out in front of the army telling us to go this way. I'm saying, what do you think we should do? You know, like how is God working through us right now? And when you build consensus that way, what happens is that people, they get buy-in immediately. They're not doing it because you told them to do it. They're doing it because we decided we're going to do it. And the other thing about that is if I stumble, which I'm going to because I'm a human being, people don't go, oh my gosh, I can't imagine Pastor Ryan would ever do that. Because they understand that I am them and they are me, right? That we are all human beings and we're all fallible. And I preach my doubts from the pulpit. And I say things like, I don't like this passage. You know, like this passage bothers me and here's why it bothers me. I walk through my thinking from the pulpit and trust that my congregation will take that in the way that I intend it to, which is that I hope that you're struggling with this passage just as much as I'm struggling. Because if you're not struggling with some parts of the Bible, you're not thinking about the Bible. Right. And I think that's the problem is that we want the pastor just to dump knowledge in our head. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be critical thinkers, right? Analyzers, just like we as pastors, we analyze the text and bring that to the congregation. One of the most powerful things I ever heard was an old pastor, guy's like 80 years old, a guy who should be as sure of himself as could be, said, here's what I think this passage means from the pulpit. And I was like, that's it right there.
Yeah.
Like that is the mentality we all need to have. Like I might be wrong. I could be wrong. I'm probably wrong about what I think this means, but at least be upfront about it, right? I'm always turned off by people who are very sure of themselves. Right. I think that's incredibly problematic. Like not to pick on anybody, but I think Mark Driscoll I'm just allergic to Mark Driscoll.
No, I get
like
it.
In every possible it. Way. Like, how are you so sure of yourself, sir? You know, like that is terrifying. Is someone who like is genetically predisposed to doubting, like I'm convinced of that. Like I'm not a true believer. Like I've never been that way. When you hear someone like that go, if that's what Christianity is,
right?
I don't want that. I can't have that. Like I need to have a sober second thought all the time. So I think churches need to be more honest about these kind of things, right? Like we don't know this. I am not better than you. I don't have all the answers. You probably have as many answers as I do. We are going to work together to get to these problems. I think that's the kind of church that these kind of nuns, the ones we're talking about, they're not drawn to the Mark Driscolls of the world.
Right.
They're drawn to the servant leaders who say, I'm just trying to, you know, I'm trying to figure this out too, but I do know this church makes me feel better. I do know that it gives me a sense of purpose and belonging and meaning. And I think that we all need that. And you know what? People are drawn to that more than if you don't believe you're going to hell.
Right.
You know, like that does not work with that, with these kind of nuns. They just want to be part of something that's not crazy, you know? And if church can provide that, the not crazy is important, by the way. if the church can provide that, then that's what they want. But unfortunately the church is not doing that.
Yeah.
Not reaching those people.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, that's the whole point of this podcast in a lot of ways, which is like, not only can we be in consensus about where we're headed and all that stuff, but your job matters just as much as my job matters. Like I'm not some like spiritual giant because I have a pastoral role. Like all of our jobs are our kingdom jobs and for God's kingdom. So there's so much good stuff in the book, and I definitely don't want to take all the, you know, all the stuff. I want people to buy it. But can you just tell me how this sort of research kind of changed your mentality about what the church even is and how to approach the world?
Yeah, I think it's that piece that we were just talking about, is that the number of like hardcore, like church hating, you know, atheists out there is so incredibly small. And actually, if you really look at the data and how do you define a nun is actually a really like big academic question.
Sure.
But like people who don't belong, people who don't behave, I mean, they never go to church, and people who don't believe, saying there is no God, is about 6% of America. It's a very small portion of the country. Right. It's like none, 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 like none on all three dimensions. Mm. Most people are in a gradient, right? From like hardcore evangelical who goes to church three times a week on one end, and then an atheist who actively tries to proselytize atheism on the other end.
Right.
That is a very small portion of the population, and like 90% of us live between those two poles.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing is that we spend all of our time creating boogeymen of the one pole, when in reality, they don't represent the rest of that group even. There's at least 25% of the population would be classified as nuns, but would not hate the idea of going to church. Right. So like there's this huge untapped, you know, group out there that get demonized. I think that's what I want to make sure that people don't, when they read the book, I hope they come back and say, okay, I understand now that those people are not those people, right? That these people don't represent those people and vice versa. And my conception in my head of how the world looks is not actually the way it looks. So, you know, when we talk about the nuns, we can't say like they're the enemy or they're like, it's like the secularists are coming for us. There's like 8% of America. Like, shut up. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not Antifa. They're not the boogeyman. All right. They don't exist in a way that you think they exist. The reality is that most people who don't go to church are not antithetical to the gospel, are not, you know, don't have a huge wall built up between the church and them. It's just they slipped away for whatever reason, or they were never grown up in a tradition, and they just don't see any benefit or value of being in a tradition. Mm. Right. So you've got to convince them. You don't have to convince them that God is real and like don't get into like metaphysical arguments about things. What you got to show them is the church doesn't hate them. The church is not what you think it is. The church can actually provide a lot of benefits to you as a person, but also to society. Right. And that you should be a part of that, because living life alone is awful. We're not designed as human beings. And this is not just a biblical worldview. This is an academic worldview, too. Mm-hmm. Like, we, you know, there are psychologists now who say that putting people in isolation, like in prison, is a form of torture, because we are meant to be in community. Right. We are social creatures. And that's what psychology says. And also, hey, guess what? Bible says it too. Right. So, we are unified in that idea. And the thing is, I would be less alarmed if these people were finding social outlets in other ways that were not online, because by the way, online community is not real community. I would be less upset if they were joining like the Elks and the Moose and the VFW and the, you know, whatever, the environmental club. I don't care. But they're not.
Yeah.
Right? They're not doing that either. So like the church needs to step in and say, hey, like we can still serve a purpose in this community, and we can actually, and I think this is so key. I think this is so, so key. The church needs to do a better job of saying the world would be worse without us in it. Mm. Because a lot of people on social are convinced that the world would be better if we taxed religious groups or abolished religion in America. They honestly believe that the world would be better without churches, because what they don't see is all the good stuff that churches do in little tiny communities all across America to feed hungry people, to provide free counseling, to keep marriages together, to give after-school programs for kids, right? To prison ministries. They don't see all that stuff because we don't walk around with big placards talking about all that stuff. Unfortunately, when churches put up signs, it's saying like about abortion or Trump or whatever else. We don't put up signs that we fed 10,000 kids last year. You know, right. So the problem is the good that we do gets kind of submerged, and the patina is all the political stuff. So I think that churches need to be more forceful in saying that we are a force for good in our community. And you might not like our politics. That's okay. But you can't deny the fact that the world would be a worse place if we went away. Kids would go hungry. People would get divorced. Kids would have no place to go after school. People in prison would have no hope. Like, that's what we do. And unfortunately, churches just don't do a good enough job of telling the good news of, because I know we're not supposed to brag, but we also need to be honest with people about what we do and the value. Because right now the story is Joel Osteen has a private jet. right, and these big mega churches, you know, are like spending all your tithe money on, you know, like suits and dinners and stuff like that. Listen here, my church, we spend 25% of our tithe revenue, 25% of our tithe revenue on feeding hungry kids in our community. 25%, a quarter of all the dollars that come in go to feeding hungry kids in our community. We fed 10,000 kids last year. A church of 20 people all over the age of 80 years old fed 10,000 kids last year who would have not been fed unless we did it. So we are a force for good in Mount Vernon, Illinois. I will say that to anybody. And, you know, even an atheist can't look at me and say, your church should go away if I tell them that. Because I don't, you know, that we are doing good. And by the way, if your church doesn't have a story like that, then you're wrong. You need to have a story like that. And if you don't, you need to create one. You need to create a ministry right now where you can say to people like that, listen, we are a force for good. Mm. This is how much we spent on clothes or food or counseling or transportation or after school materials for these kids. That's what the church needs to do. And you know what's going to happen? Those nothing in particulars are going to look at that and go, maybe the church is not all about MAGA Trump. Maybe it's about actually doing good for the world. And I can be a part of that.
Right.
I can join something like that. And then the more they join, the more good you can do.
Right.
You know, so that to me, that's the feedback loop that needs to happen. And churches are just doing now. Listen, I think the PR wars we're losing anyway. You're going to lose it anyway.
Right.
But the church needs to do better, especially locally, about tooting its own horn a little bit and justifying its existence in a more forceful way to its critics outside. Because otherwise, the narrative becomes Creflo Dollar and Joel Osteen and prosperity gospel. When in reality, that is less than 1% of what churches are in America.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right. That's good stuff, Ryan. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, even feeling a little convicted myself and just kind of thinking through some of that stuff. So what are the best ways for people to sort of find you, find the book, all that sort of stuff?
You know, Twitter's like the center of my world, at Ryan Burge. You can find me on there. I tweet all the articles and things I'm working on, you know, all come out from there. My website is ryanburge.net. My email is really easily findable. So you can just Google me and you can find my email if you want to email me about anything. I write for Christianity Today sometimes. I write for Religion News Service. I write for Religion Unplugged. And I write for our own website, which I want to tout right now. It's called Religion in Public, religioninpublic.blog. We started in 2017. We got 23,000 hits that first year. We got 30,000 hits our second year. We got 100,000 hits our third year. We got 180,000 hits in 2020. So it's really become, we get 400 or 500 clicks every single day now from people. We write about 75 articles a year. So there's a huge backlog. There's like 250 articles on that website now, all rigorous academic, empirical political science, a lot of them written by myself or my co-editor, Paul Jupe from Denison University. So if you really want to understand social science that's sort of pitched towards a more general audience about religion and politics, that is the goal of that whole thing. So you could spend days on there reading stuff that we've written over the last 3 or 4 years, and you would come away with a lot better understanding of the way the world works. So especially pastors out there, I would highly recommend you go on that website and start reading stuff to get a better conception of what your flock looks like, but also what the world looks like. And more generally, things like Christian nationalism, we talk about prosperity gospel, the religiously unaffiliated. I'm always writing on there about stuff. I write about 2 or 3 pieces a month that go on religionandpublic.blog. So that's a good place to get in contact with me. You can always email me, ryanburge@gmail.com. And I'm up for the conversation. I love interacting with pastors and non-pastors. I just love the whole conversation. I want to be a resource for people to help them understand the world in a better way.
I love it.
And the book, I gotta plug the book, I guess, right? The book is called The Nuns, Where They Came From, Who They Are, and Where They're Going. It is pre-order on Amazon right now. It comes out March the 9th of 2021. So you can get the Kindle version or the soft cover. I think the soft cover is $19.99. It comes from Fortress Press. It's 31,000 words, 160 pages, 42 graphs. It's a quick read. You're not gonna be bogged down with tons and tons of text. I don't like long books, so I don't write long books. So you could knock this out in a couple hours, and I feel like it would be a great resource for yourself. And I think it would be like a good small group study to go through, like in a small group, like a home church, like a cell group kind of thing, to walk through that. Like in a month, you could go through the whole book, and you come out on the other side with a lot of thoughts about how to reach the people in your community that you're trying to reach.
Yeah. That's awesome. I appreciate all that. I'll make sure it's in the show notes so everybody can find you and find the blog and all that stuff. I know what I'm going to be doing, you know, the rest of today. So, okay. So are you cool jumping into the final two questions then, Ryan?
Let's do it.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Oh man, that's a good one. So I was dating a girl in high school whose dad ran the physical plant for the high school. Like he was like the head maintenance guy. Yeah. And one of the guys got hurt and was on disability, and they needed someone to mow the grass, all summer at the high school. So my job for the summer between my last year in high school, my first year in college, I mowed grass 40 hours a week at the high school. It was like 45 acres, like football fields, like the front lot. Like I got there at 6:30 in the morning. I mowed grass till 3:30 in the afternoon. And I thought I was going to go crazy. I started like singing to myself out there. Cause this is before like you could really like have iPods and things like that. Cause this is like 20 years ago. So I really couldn't like put, you know, earbuds in and like listen to something. Like that would have saved my sanity. But like that job was awesome for like the first like 2 days. And then like, I was like, oh my gosh, like what did I get myself into, mowing grass for 40 hours a week. But you know what? I think it was a good way to get to know myself. You know, in terms of like just being alone with yourself, because you can't hear anything because the mower is so loud and you're looking at the same thing over and over again because you're basically just driving in a circle over and over again. So that was like, it's not weird in terms of like what I was doing, but like how I was doing it was very, very odd. Plus, I was with a bunch of older guys. The rest of the maintenance crew was all like guys in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. I was 18 years old at the time. Right. So let's just say I grew up pretty fast.
That'll do it.
In the break room and during lunch. that was a job I'll never forget. It was definitely, I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's a lot of mowing lawns. Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I think it's to figure out, what can you do better than anybody else? I remember I like to watch like venture capitalist shows like Shark Tank and things like that. Sure. There's a podcast called The Pitch where they basically just do Shark Tank audio version. And there's a really interesting investor, a guy named Chris Sacca, who is one of the earliest investors in some of the biggest companies in the world. He's like a multi-billionaire now. He said in one of these pitch groups, you know, he was on the fence about this idea. And he said, what is your unfair advantage? That's what he said to the pitcher. What is your unfair advantage? What is the one thing that you can bring to this product that no one else on earth can bring to this product? Like why are you the one to do this, to make this go to the moon? You know, why are you that person? And I think that everyone has something in their life that is their unfair advantage, and that you need to figure that out and then just exploit the heck out of it. Make that your, you know, like I'm not a big believer in like trying to be well-rounded. Like I'm an awful cook and my wife is a great cook. I have no desire to be a good cook because I don't need to be a good cook. My wife is great at it. And plus I could always order out if I wanted to. Like I don't need to spend my time learning how to cook because I know what I'm good at, which is making graphs and communicating those to a general audience to help them understand the social world. And no one stands in the straddle between the academic world and the ministry world like I do. So I'm going to exploit the heck out of that. That is my thing. That is my lane. That is why I exist. So if someone else worked at a 10 and I worked at 10 on the same thing, I'd get farther because I had the unfair advantage.
Yeah.
So find your unfair advantage and exploit it. Push it 100%. Be what you are. And you know what's going to happen? You are going to be rewarded for that because you are better at that than everybody else. And people are going to find that you are better at that than everybody else. So figure out what the one thing you have that no one else has and just focus everything you have on that area and just be really great at it.
That's good. I appreciate that. That's great advice. Ryan, it's so nice to get to talk to you. And I appreciate the info.
Thanks, Curry. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Ryan and just how political science and social sciences plays into the church. I encourage you to pick up that book, The Nuns. It makes you feel like you actually know what you're talking about because it's so easy to read and understandable. Make sure and check that out. And I think that word from him, it just keeps resonating with me, is if your church wasn't here, would anybody miss it? Would anybody know? I think that's a good word for all of us. In understanding what our role is in the church in this world. And so I just challenge you in your church, in your community, you know, in your family, you know, would the world miss you if you were gone? And so how do we work in that world? And so I think those are valuable lessons. Now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review for me there. It just helps get the word out about the podcast. I know I say that every week, but I really do appreciate it. The ratings are in reviews. Go do all that for me. And until next time, get out there and hustle.